kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 94, with me, Doug Belshaw.
And me, Di Barnes. Hello, Doug.
It's been a while, Di. You all right?
It has been a while, hasn't it? I am in holiday mode. So school's out for Christmas, as it were. That happened on Friday afternoon, and I've been quite busy since then until yesterday. And when I think I'm specialising in becoming a couch potato. That's a thing.
Well, to be fair, you work 6 days a week, so I think, well, sometimes seven, so I think that's fair enough.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I'm going to India on Boxing Day on a school trip, so I'm with 20 pupils, so I'm kind of...
So that's a week today, so it's we're recording this on the evening of the 19th of December, and so you're going in a week's time, yeah?
Is it just a week today? Wow. Mm. yes, I am, so I have to get ready for that, and but also just do some relaxation, so I get back, and then I'm working the next day after we return. So that's cool. Very good. How about you? How you been doing?
I'm all right. I've been here, there, and everywhere. I've been to a place called Leeuwarden, something like that, in the Netherlands, which is going to be European Capital of Culture in 2018, so they're doing the place up. Very nice place. And the place I stayed was... Post Plaza, which used to be a post office, and the next door was a bank. And we actually did, as part of this week-long work I was doing with the Provincial Library Service around digital literacies and open badges, we actually had a tour one evening around a guy who used to be a history teacher and now does these tours, and told a fascinating story about, the short version is basically the post office was occupied by the Nazis. The Canadian Allied forces were coming in, and they didn't want to leave the post office as kind of a viable communications option for the Allies. So they'd put 72 bombs in the basement, and it was all ready to be blown up as the Allies advanced. And the resistance found out about this, because two of the postal workers were in the resistance, and they got some friends who specialised in forging passports and smuggled a bomb out and got them to make exactly the same size and weight fake bomb, and then smuggled them in one by one and replaced the real bombs, so that when they finally, you know, lit the fuse, when the Allies were coming, nothing happened. Which I thought was amazing. But Leeuwarden is lovely. It's surrounded by this canal system. I had a great time. Jeroen de Boer invited me over. Hi, Jeroen, if you're listening. And just had a great time, did all kinds of stuff, including going to a place in Zeeland, Middelburg, and they had this amazing library with a makerspace, and off the back of that I bought a 3D printer, which I am now using with my kids. It's called a Flashforge Finder, so I highly recommend it, £400, and really does do the job, it's wonderful.
Well, it sounds like a bargain. Very good. So episode 93, which was a couple of 3 weeks ago now, was we talked about Snakeify, and Snakeify must have seen that we'd linked to them in the show notes, and they listened to our podcast and tweeted out that we were talking about them, which is very good. Snakeify is a Python learning platform where you can connect and as a teacher with your pupils, and it's all for free. I thoroughly recommend it. Does lots of things really, really well. So that was very good. And this morning I was listening to the Hurry Slowly podcast by Jocelyn Gly. And in this one, she talked about some research done.
Oh, is this the new mini episode she's doing?
This is she's trying a sort of a mini episode every three episodes or something.
Oh, that's interesting. I listened to this today as well. So go on.
Okay. Well, the thing that struck me in this, and it was the research called Brain Drain. The mere presence of one's own smartphone reduces available cognitive capacity. And there was this sort of really, and I haven't read it in detail, but she talks about it interestingly. And in that these experiments that have been done, this research at the University of Chicago, I think, it's in their journals anyway, is that if your phone is nearby, as in the same room as you, it actually, with on silence, so no vibrations, no nothing, no distraction from it directly, it still is draining you, reducing your cognitive capacity, because you're thinking about it, and the only thing to do is to put it in another room.
Didn't she say that the researchers said that if when they asked people directly, are you distracted because of your phone? They'd say no, and they didn't even realize that their cognitive capacity or their performance was objectively being reduced.
Exactly.
And I think, was it three scenarios? There was in a different room, there was in a bag out of sight, but in the same room, and then there was on the desk, I think, or something like that.
It just made me think about that, and I think it's whether how much water that holds for me and my experience. So just not just me, but my experience of young people as well doing their work and adults as well. And it is something that you have to learn how to manage. I think to be fair, if you're trying to do your productivity well, and I think one of the things about it being in another room is quite simply the temptation. So it's when you have a lull in mind. So I had this really interesting conversation, and one of my upper six pupils introduced me to this game about paperclips. Have you seen this game about paperclips?
No.
I can't remember what it's called. I wasn't going to talk about this, but
what do you have to do?
It's awesome. Hang on, what's it called? Is it called Ultimate Paperclips or something? It's just in your browser, but there's a thing. Universal Paperclips. Is it universal? Yes, okay. Yes. So here we go. It's decisionproblem.com/paperclip. I'll put a link in. So basically what happens is once you start making paperclips, and you have different variables that you can control. And so you can, lower and raise the price, and you work out, you can put marketing in at certain cost, and you have to buy the wire to make the paperclips and such like. And it just keeps going forever and ever and ever. So one of my students was mathematically spellbound by this and played it for 3 days. Whilst he was doing other things, and got up to some quintillion number of paperclips that they made, and finished the game. And as you go further and further, it introduces more elements that you can control, and increase your productivity and your sales and your revenue. And you have to work out what are the best indicators of business, as it were. And anyway, so this just sits there, and it takes actual time for the paperclips to be sold. And so I've only played it, I think we played it for a double lesson, so it's about an hour and a half where we all had it running and we were messing about whilst we were doing our work. But then one of the students has actually put it onto his phone, and now has his phone sitting there building paperclips as he does his work. And he's a very sober young man, and he fully believes that it improves his productivity, having his phone sitting there watching these paperclips tick up. In their hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands, as he sets the parameters out. So it's quite interesting. But I'll put the clip in the show notes in case anyone's interested.
That's fascinating. I remember a lesson when I was wet behind the ears, newly qualified teacher, where the head of department, and I remember going in thinking, oh my goodness, what a waste of time this is. And then realized afterwards it was absolute genius. He had them making... He showed them how to make like little origami things out of paper, and they had to make as many as they possibly could. And once they'd finished, they had to come up the desk and he'd give them a certain amount. And then like he was basically playing the role of the unfair factory owner by then reducing the amount. And now they had to do more. And then he was giving them tokens instead of money, so they could only do that in the factory shop. And like just basically teaching them through doing, I thought it was genius.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting thing, and I wonder, it kind of made me think why schools don't, there aren't more businesses in schools, as in young people trying to start businesses that make money for charity and such like. So our students have been doing loads of fundraising, and have raised about £13,000, I think, for the India, for the Dalit children in India. And I'll give a shout out to the Supporting Dalit Children charity that I'll put the link in the show notes if anyone's interested. But you can sponsor a child in India for £240 a year, I think, at school. I just thought it would make sense, to do these things.
Yeah, although as I was wondering, so another place I've been is Dublin. And the reason I was in Dublin last Thursday and Friday was to meet up with my new colleagues. Now, these are people who I actually already knew. Mary Cooch and Gavin Henrick and Garnet Berry And Karen Holland. I didn't actually know Karen, I have to say, who's Gavin's partner, but she works in Moodle as well. So it was, you know, we did VR stuff. So I was using HTC Vive, which was amazing. We were doing all kinds of stuff. It was great. When I was wandering around Dublin city centre, I realised just how many charities and organisations were just asking for money and busking and doing all this kind of stuff. And it got a bit tiring, I have to say. And yeah, I'm all for enterprise and schools, but yeah.
Well, I think that's the thing, though. Is what I was thinking is that because I'm not a fan of doing things for charity. I don't think that sounds really bad.
He says, "How did Movember go, Dan?"
It went very well. We earned $2,500 in the end, so that was very good. There were 20 teachers taking part, and it was lovely to shave. But that's the first time in my adult life that I've ever done a sponsor form or a sponsorship of any kind in that way, and asked friends and colleagues for money accordingly, which was quite interesting. Not quite interesting at all, actually. Because it's not something that I really like. I mean, so I donate to different charitable organizations in different ways. It's odd to work out how, I don't know. I just don't like the idea of people going around petitioning for money to do something that, that isn't really substantial. So if you're going to go and run a marathon, go and run a marathon. Oh yeah, I'll pay you some money, but it doesn't really, do you know what I mean? I always had the impression that people did that. So if you're going to run 26 miles, well, I'll pay you 10p a mile. And then that'll be £2.60 that I give you when you, if you complete the thing. And that's the thing. It's like, it's a real challenge and, you know, you have to actually get there. But that if you don't, you get part thereof. But obviously that's complicated to do because then it's easier to collect the money at the time that the person sponsors you. And also now it's all online, obviously.
I'm just looking at your Movember page now. You did really well, actually. I think out of, you know, if it was a competition in terms of how much money you raised, then you were in the top five.
Well, that's good.
And that tash was looking quite
well by the end. I mean, just at the time, impressive. But people just went into the idea of posting a picture of their mustaches every day, which I thought was like, that was it. I thought that's what you did, really. It's kind of part of the game. Anyway, that doesn't matter, does it? If you're going to do that, I'd actually, if you have form an enterprise that is actually useful, that you can, if you make a product that people find useful, then there you go. That's what you're really after, isn't it? I think. It's not like a school thing. It's not like a charity thing. It's like people are buying something that they really want to do anyway, or that they might desire anyway in some way, and you're making money for charity, and it's your work that's making the money for the charity, kind of. Anyway,
I'd like to encourage people to go back into the show notes from Tide 92 and click on the link to Movember, and then go through to Di's page and scroll down to day 22 when he has a big pipe in his mouth, which is hilarious. Oh dear, there's one with a hat.
There we go. It's proper. Yeah. I think I won a prize. We had a prize giving in the cloisters with all the pupils, which was a bit of a damp squib, I think, or a wet fart. I don't know. But so we tell it, and there was a microphone and speakers, and the guy who organized it all made his great efforts to make a deal and have applause as the thing that awarded the prizes to the different teachers, for the best style, the best groomed, and all that kind of crap.
Okay.
And the children were smiling, hiding over the other side. It was quite funny.
It's not a very British thing to do.
Quite
cringy. Interesting. Talking about beards and facial hair, there was quite a lot of that at the Tech Co-op Summit I went to at the end of November. So this was the one I mentioned, I think, in the last episode about this stately home, which is run by a workers' cooperative, Wortley Hall, near Sheffield. Absolutely beautiful place, Ty. Amazing. And different trade unions had endowed a room to restore it. And the main room, I mean, some of the pictures I took, I wrote a blog post about it. And I think I put something about destroying capitalism. the room, the whole place was in such a state of disrepair that the main kind of grand room, you could see the sky through it, and it was repaired over a number of years by people, uh-huh, you know, working in cooperation. And so we did all kinds of stuff, and it was really good. This is called CoTech. It's a cooperative technologist, so it's a network of technology focused cooperatives, which was good. I wrote a few blog posts actually since we last spoke, which I've got a lot of pictures in because people seem to like that these days. And so I called the one for Wortley Hall "Destroying Capitalism One Stately Home at a Time." So let me put that link in there. And then the one from Loy Warden, that had a few pictures in as well. And the really nice thing about that was that not only had they hired me for the week, but they'd hired a guy called Edward Cobus, who then kind of did sketch notes all the way through the week. So he made me look more intelligent, which was awesome. That was in week note 49. That's the end of what I've been up to there.
I'm just looking. The pictures do look great. It's nice to see John and Brian and Laura. Hello, you three. Happy Christmas.
Someone called us not a bad looking cooperative.
Not unattractive.
A not unattractive cooperative, yes, that's right.
You do look like a lovely set. The building looks beautiful.
It was amazing. It was just a such a lovely place. And if you go to the blog post, the picture underneath the one of our co-op,
I'm just looking at the scene.
That roof there.
Wow.
Yeah, that was basically, it had things on the walls telling you about how it was done. A guy who must have had a job during the summer months spent two winters basically on his back lying on a mattress painting that in the kind of 60s.
It just looks gorgeous, like really, really beautiful. Mm-hmm. So I've seen a lot of roofs around different cities, and not a lot, some. And this one, it looks really quite wonderful.
Yeah,
I have to say, very good
stuff. Oh, the other thing, which is what I'm working on at the moment. So it's currently Tuesday. My birthday is on Friday, when I reach the ripe old age of 37. I refuse to work on my birthday. So I'm still not employed by Moodle until the 2nd of January, in which I'll be working 4 days a week and one day through the co-op. I'm working Wednesday and Thursday, and the thing I'm finishing off is the draft of a MoodleNet white paper. I'm still not entirely sold on the name Project MoodleNet because I think it unhelpfully confuses the existing Moodle.net stuff with the new thing, which is trying to be like a professional social, a new open social media platform for educators focused on professional development and open content. So I've written about 5,500 words in this white paper. I've got a couple of sections left to write, which I'll do tomorrow and Thursday. And then the idea is that will inform, well, that will get feedback from the community, and then that will inform the technical specification which for building in early 2018.
Oh, okay. Very good. Sorry, I'm just getting distracted by your pictures and your week notes. Very nice.
All right. Yeah, I think I'm going to do more of that, actually, put more pictures in.
Oh, no, it's good. If you're going...
I am, actually, just as an aside...
Go on.
Yeah, go on. I was just going to say, as an aside, the pictures... So I used those pictures and December the 1st. Is that right? So recently, I decided I was going to get rid of the Oxygen OS, which powers my OnePlus 5... Uh-huh. smartphone, and I was going to replace it with what's it called, Lineage OS, which is, you know, the next version of Cyanogen Mod, the open source one. And that was because there were a couple of backdoors found in Oxygen OS which could potentially be triggered, etc. Anyway, I was in Dublin talking to one of my new colleagues, Mary Cooch, at the bar, and she was like, oh, so why do you choose that phone? I said, well, the battery life's really good and the camera's really good, although I've just installed this new operating system, which means that my battery life isn't as good and the camera doesn't recognize both cameras on the back. And then I went back and I thought, why have I done this? So I've actually installed the latest beta of Oxygen OS, which is now Android 8, so it's Oreo, and I'm back to the really good, amazing camera on it. And it's so good because it's got the two cameras on the back, which does the portrait mode, you know, blurs the background, that I don't really need to use my like proper camera anymore. So it's fantastic.
I have heard very good things about it. But the problem with taking photos is that you have to be somewhere, you've been going places where you've got pictures to take. It's when you haven't, that's the issue with photos and posts and things like that. I remember once upon a time I used to walk deliberately every time I saw something that had potential meaning, I would take a picture of it so that I could use it in different posts of just things I'd taken on the hoof, you know, and have a look at this little stock of pictures.
I think it's a good thing to do. And, you know, I'm starting to, I need to do a bit more thinking about my setup. This is the time of year when I become dissatisfied with my digital presence and start thinking about things again. And instead of saying what I'm going to do, I'll say what I have done on this podcast, I think, because, you know, it's easy to conjure with words, whereas I think actually pointing to stuff you've done is a bit easier.
It is more useful.
Or more useful.
Because we can all talk crap, can't we? Yeah.
Did you listen to that episode of the... Have you listened to every episode of that Hobby Slotty podcast or just that?
There's only been 11, so no.
Yeah, did you listen to the one on sleep?
Only because I don't have a lot... So this is the thing, you see. What is it? To have the power to accept the things that you can change or accept the things you can't change and change the things you can. I can't really change how I sleep because of my job, so I don't.
No, but you can, because some of the things, some of the advice that was being given that was really good. So I listened to that one. I think it must have been number 10. So I listened to that one yesterday and finished it off today and then listened to number 11 while I was running. And I forgot the name of the one, Anne, somebody other. She was saying, you know, she was saying the usual stuff, you know, like no blue light before bedtime, but she was being very sensible about, you know, it can be quite normal to wake up in the middle of the night, etc. And she was talking about, you know, not doing exercise and all the usual things. But she was also saying that often people are so busy rushing around the place that the only time they've actually got to think about the future properly is when they're lying down in bed. And that can cause anxiety. So she suggests that you should take some time at the end of the day to write down everything, like to consciously think about stuff you've got to do, and then make a list of the things which are in your direct control that you could actually do right now before you go to bed, and the things which aren't in your control. So you've processed all that stuff, because she says that it's quite often that which causes a disturbed night's sleep. And then Jocelyn K. Gly actually reflects at the end of the... she says it's been a couple of months since the recording of the interview. And then she reflects at the end of each podcast. And she was saying that she's given up drinking alcohol before bed any time. And she said that's made a huge difference to her...
No way.
To
sleep patterns,
which was...
Is alcohol not helpful?
I was quite surprised at. Yeah. Because she said that... Yeah, apparently alcohol plays absolute havoc with you know, your sleeping patterns.
Okay. Oh, that's not good now.
Well, it's Christmas, so whatever.
Well, I wouldn't be drinking. I'm in India, so that's fine. Cool. Okay. So let's move on from our personal crap into other crap. So you put an article from the New York Times in here called "Laptops are Great." They are. I think that's a fair thing to say. But not during a lecture or a meeting. What's this all about?
Right. So the first thing that I do when I see something like this, which is, you know, challenges my beliefs, and I should do this for things which don't challenge my beliefs as well, because I think laptops are fine in lecture theatres. So I say, okay, Susan Dynarski, is she a staff writer or is she somebody who's writing for the New York Times and doesn't actually work for them? Like, is this a journalist or not? And so I go down the bottom and it says, Susan Dynarski is a professor of education, public policy and economics at the University of Michigan. All right. So first of all, I think, oh, right. Okay. This is someone with skin in the game. So that's good. But also someone with a vested interest in, you know, the status quo of universities, potentially. Yeah. And then I look at the way it's written and it seems to be cherry picking evidence. But at the same time, the examples that she's given are of people making notes in lectures. And so it's hard to disagree with the fact that if you make notes on laptops in lectures, it's worse than making notes on with a pen and paper. Right? Like, I don't think that's a... Like, if you're just typing what the person says, that's just, like, doing trying to do stuff verbatim rather than thinking through things, drawing diagrams, making connections. And when I was in Leywarden, actually, Ilona Kish, who was the other speaker on the Monday, who is director of an EU project around Libraries 2020, and actually spoke to her as a follow-up today, she was saying how, given how digital she perceives me, she thought it was great that I was making notes on with pen and paper. And I said, well, you just use the best tool for the job. So with this particular article, I would say that the problem isn't necessarily with how people are taking notes. It's the problem is with the lecture format itself. Like, if the whole point is for someone to speak and you to make notes on what they're saying, that seems like a broken system in 2017.
Maybe. I don't know. I think when you come back to this, right? So if you're sitting in a lecture, and it depends how many people there are in that lecture, depends on what can go on in the lecture. So, and this is not dissimilar to the classroom in some ways. And a lot of tech is about bringing different ways of sharing, of gathering people's opinions. And and so if you have 200 people need to sit in a lecture theater, and then one person who needs to guide what those people need to know, then that's sort of quite important. And I would argue that it would be better. So what is the purpose of that lecture? Is that the person at the front of the room is saying stuff that the people in the room need to know. And that's okay, in my opinion.
But they're not, like, the whole, like, I've got no problem if they're teaching in the sense of it not just being a one-way thing, right? But I can't see the... and as if it's like part of a repertoire of stuff, fair enough. But, you know, if we're really defending universities as being primarily about lectures where someone stands at the front and students make notes, like, that seems broken.
But I don't think any university schedules its learning in just that way, in that one dynamic. There'll be seminars and other things that students need to go to, I would have thought, and then papers that they need to prepare and tutorials they need to go to and whatever. You know, there's lots of different ways of making sure that everyone is getting their education and that it is.
Okay, so let me try a different way, right? So if it is going to be like that, and so I do recognize that there are times when there's stuff you just need to learn, you can't pause and rewind a live lecture. Yeah?
Correct.
So what's the point in continuing doing it live time after time after time?
No, so I kind of agree with that. So I was just trying to think. So there are different ways of doing this. And if your lectures were recorded and made available to it later, that would be the way to go and make notes on a lecture. And that would probably be a very useful thing. But sitting in the lecture and being participant live in it has a certain integrity to it, I think. Being there at the point of, although it's not actually necessary. But if you think about the conferences that you go and speak at, for example, you're giving lectures effectively, and people are taking notes as they see fit. But really what you want them doing is thinking about what it is that you're saying and following what you're saying, and then reflecting upon how that is relevant to their lives and how they can take whatever it is you're talking about into their workplace or whatever. And
which is why I don't accept speaking engagements now. I very rarely accept speaking engagements where I only get to basically lecture at people. I pretty much insist that I'm going to do some kind of workshop as well, because I feel like just trying to download your belief system or way of viewing the world, or the knowledge that you have gained so far into people's heads via didactic teaching in a live format
seems not satisfactory.
Seems problematic.
No,
Anyway, so but this article is trying to say that the problem, it's not a structural problem, it's the student's problem. Yeah, so it's a form of, well, victim blaming is the wrong term, but it's almost like that in terms of like, oh hey, look at what the students are doing wrong.
Yes, and it's an easy thing to do, but so. I think different things about this. So if your laptop is set up for you to be undistracted whilst you're taking notes and you're in the right mindset whilst you're using your laptop to take notes during the lecture, I don't see a laptop being an issue whatsoever. If it's not done that way, then it's not really, the laptop can be distracting. The student will just go and check Facebook or check their email or do some other work or whatever it might be. Or go off and be checking even things to do with the lecture that they're sitting in whilst they're sitting in the lecture rather than listening to the lecturer. I'm also not scared of the idea that there's going to be somebody who's expert in the room who can actually guide, give a lecture, and it is very, very interesting and they're the person with the knowledge and they're sharing it with lots of other people. And I don't mind that. I'm not, but I agree that it needs to. Obviously, it can't be. That's not the only level of learning that is required. But I also think that handwritten notes, you know, if somebody wants to be distracted during a lecture, they will be distracted during a lecture. It's a human thing, I think. I remember sitting in many lessons writing crap out as a pupil in school. And the only thing really going on in my mind was the quality of my handwriting and nothing to do with the content that was being regurgitated. So I remember doing macroeconomics A level. And the teacher would read to us from a book and we would have to write out what he was saying word for word, and people would stop him and ask him to repeat to make sure they got it right and things like that. And it was, that never helped me. It was an awful, awful way to learn sort of thing, because all I was really interested in is whether I could write neatly at a speed. I was trying to follow the things, but you'd never get a chance whilst these thoughts are going through your head, or whilst these words are coming into your mind, I would never have a chance to question what was being said, or to sort of try and seek clarification on something. And so you would end up just in a kind of autopilot mode of not actually concentrating on the content and the material whatsoever, and only on superficial things. And so I would say that entirely up to the individual how they're going to use the tools that they use, and the tools aren't really at fault. And therefore, this article is possibly misled or misleading, saying that laptops are there.
Yeah, and also it tacks on, you know, laptops are great but not in lectures, and then it tacks on in meetings as well. And you think, well, all of the stuff you're talking about is higher education and lecture format. So, and if you think about this podcast, you know, people download this podcast and they listen to it asynchronously. They can listen to it as many times as they want, and I can look at the stats that people listen to it more than once, which is awesome. And yeah, imagine if we only did this live, and we did it, every group of people who wants this, and we had to rehearse the conversation again. It just seems,
I think it is. It is weird.
Anyway, this,
isn't it? It's an interesting.
This links to another article that you've put in about, from the TES.
Yes, it does, about mobile phones. Well, this is interesting to me. So I unbanned mobile phones in my school, and then they got rebanned after a couple of years, sadly, for this year. And and I do agree with this gentleman, Bernard Trafford, who is a writer, educationalist and musician, former head teacher of the Royal Grammar School, Newcastle, and past chair of the HMC. Yeah, he is just kind of saying, look, stop trying to fight the tide, and stop trying to stop putting locks and blocks in place that don't work or are very hard for a teacher to enforce. It'd be much better to actually embrace how you use your mobile phone in the classroom, and then everyone would be adhering to a set of standards and kind of learning how to do things right rather than everyone just getting it wrong all of the time. And I really thought this is correct when I read this. You know, this is the right approach. It's people don't learn about things by them being locked out of their lives.
Exactly. I wondered why his name, Bernard Trafford, is familiar, but it says he used to be head teacher of the Royal Grammar School in Newcastle.
Yeah, and he's and then chair of the HMC as well.
Yeah, which is interestingly, the Royal Grammar School in Newcastle, RGS as it's known, is where Chris Wilde is now. Chris was doing all kinds of makery tinkery things with the what used to be the CLC in Newcastle, and then working for North Tyneside on maker boxes and all kinds of stuff, and he's now head of like digital education, like your kind of role, but at RGS.
Okay, interesting. Well, hello, Chris, if you're listening.
Yeah, he's a good guy. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, this seems to be... So it's funny because we started off this podcast talking about the Hurry Slowly thing, about the availability of mobile phones and all that kind of stuff. But then I guess the counterpoint of that is you can't just always have them in a different room or always have them locked away in a box. Otherwise, you don't know how to use them effectively. You don't know how to use them in a way which you don't get addicted to, where you know how it's to use them appropriately, etc.
Yeah, and I kind of think it comes back to the same point I was making in that people are either going to be getting this right or they're not. I don't think, like even in the research that's cited by... what's her name, Jocelyn Gly, that it's not going to be the same for everybody. Do you know what I mean? So there are certain times that I'm working and my mobile phone is right next to me or part of what I'm doing, and it's absolutely fine. I don't have a problem because I feel the pressure with the work. Like, I've just done a whole series of writing reports for all of my pupils. It's a lot of work, and my mobile phone isn't a distraction, sort of thing, because I'm focused and I'm wanting to make sure I get the work done in a given amount of time and get them complete for deadline. And so the mobile phone's not a big deal in that regard, as a means of distraction, or indeed taking my cognitive functionality or reducing it anyway. So I don't think that's all necessarily that true, but I do feel that it's a true point in some circumstances. I do feel that that people reach for their phone and that becomes that sort of twitchy behavior kind of thing. And and it's the sort of path of least resistance is when your mind hits a block, your productivity will, you know, your cognitive function, I guess, will go towards a path of least resistance, which very often is picking up the mobile phone to check for new notifications or updates or whatever.
Well, that's what Jocelyn Clay Gly was saying, wasn't she, at the end of that short podcast that we both listened to, that maybe, you know, we need to start wearing a watch instead of, you know, using our phone as a timepiece, or, you know, getting a bedside clock, or I think like going for a walk without your phone, or like just doing little things where she talked about, what was it, reflexive attention, where you're training your brain. The more your phone is useful to you, the more you're training your brain to pay this reflexive attention to your phone.
Yeah.
Because there might be something useful coming in. But of course, there's so many things that you use your phone for. You end up, you know, it's not surprising that you end up constantly looking to your phone just in case there's something coming in. I mean, I've got in front of me now, and at any given time, I could be checking a million things. I turn off a lot of the notifications. But yeah, and she, in that, I mean, I'd highly recommend people go and listen to that episode, because she says that the thing which has tied together all 10 episodes of her podcast so far is people struggling or dealing with or thinking about the role of the smartphone in their life.
I think I think it's a really, really interesting. So if you go, I kind of think what happens with tech is it does get like a river, you know, you kind of sit like you're on a raft on the river, or you're sitting on your phone kind of thing. And it just takes you down the river and just keep going and keep going. If you look at tech, or you look at learning, or you look at whatever you're doing as, how would you do all of these things without the technology? So you have no technology and you have to do whatever it is you have to do. And then start reintroducing technology into that workflow, and only in the places where you consider it to be of value. And I think that's where she's coming from that at, is that it's not just the phone. It's like all technology is becoming more and more part of how we have to do everything. And it is such a time saver. For example, shopping is you know, the idea of going to the shops becomes something that you just don't do. So I do my grocery shopping in real life now rather than online. But I did it for many, many years online for a family because that was the most simple thing to do. But now it's not because it costs too much. And I just don't need that much stuff. And but to actually go to a shop to buy a pair of shorts to go to India, for example, and I'm just thinking, do I have to do that? I'll just buy them online, surely.
It's interesting because that's, I mean, so many fantastic. This is, I mean, for me, that podcast is my kind of one of the finds of the year for me. Episode 9, for example, if you haven't listened to it, is Tyler Cowan. And I listened to this one. It's funny how you remember where you listen to podcasts as well, especially if you're in a new place. Uh-huh. That episode is talking about the quiet dangers of complacency. And he, you know, I'm like you, Di. I live in a place where I can't easily get all the stuff that I want, so I buy loads of stuff on Amazon. I think out of all the stuff I've bought my wife for Christmas, I've bought like one thing not from Amazon, maybe, which I bought in Dublin. But he's talking about complacency and how, you know, in a world where we can find the perfect partner, in inverted commas, by using online dating, where we can find the perfect whatever it is by going online and using our one-click Amazon order, we become complacent. And he gives the example of always wanting to make sure that you have a good time when you go out for a meal or for a drink or for entertainment. So you look up, you know, TripAdvisor and Foursquare and everything like this, and there's no serendipity to it. Like, there's no, like, walking down the street, paying attention and doing things. We use Google Maps to get where we want to be. And he says, while all these things are awesome, because we do them all the time, not only do they kind of lose their shine and luster, but also we don't really know how to do it any other way all of a sudden.
I think that's quite possibly true. But I also think that, so in the trips that I've taken abroad, I think using the internet to find good locations to go and eat, to go and spend my time, to go and see whatever, go for walks, has been an absolute godsend, having Google Maps and not just being lost all the time. And I think the joy of serendipity, and I am really concerned because all of that involves a crazy amount of homogenization. You know, if everybody is doing the same thing, then you're only going to find, you're going to drive everyone towards the same venues or towards the same products or the same films or whatever it might be, same music. And And I do worry about that hugely, but the problem with the sort of serendipitous approach is that, you know, 9 times out of 10, you're going to get a bum deal kind of thing. You know, you're going to go somewhere looking for something and not really find anything that's very good, especially if you're in a strange place and all that kind of thing. I don't know.
But then I talked about this on the podcast when I came back from Miami. We went to a restaurant because the places that we wanted to go weren't available. We were really hungry and went to this restaurant, weren't expecting much, and the food was unbelievable. And then I was scheduled to go back home, but my colleagues stayed for an extra night. And when they, you know, were raving about this place, you know, the feedback I got from the people who they took there was that, yeah, it was good. But like, it wasn't amazing because you hadn't stumbled across this amazing thing. Like, you were expecting the second time because of the review of the previous person, you were expecting for it to be amazing. So, yeah, it's a funny balance. I don't think either. I wouldn't want to go either one side or another. Wouldn't want to live my life just on serendipity mode. But nor do I really want to do it all on only go places and that people have seen and rated highly.
I completely concur, and that's the truth of it, isn't it? Is that sometimes it can be really useful.
Yeah.
Just like the laptop in your lectures, just like the mobile phone in your classroom, etc., etc. It can be really useful, but you have to kind of be aware of all of the things that are involved, the elements at play, and that. And I think what you just talked about with expectations when you actually enter the place. So if you've been told something is fantastic and it's got a 9 out of 10 on TripAdvisor or whatever, and then you rock up and you're going to say it's fantastic too, even though it might not have been or something like that. You know, your expectations are going to be different. Whereas if you stumble across it, that serendipity factor is laced with good feeling,
While we're talking about the laptops and the mobile phones and distraction, I wrote a blog post this morning about creating a distraction-free writing machine using whatever you've got available. And this, you know, sometimes you get a bee in your bonnet. I know Brian Mothers recently has been re-tinkering around with JavaScript and SVGs and doing all kinds of amazing stuff, which I'm sure he's going to share with the world soon enough. But this one was me thinking, I just want something where when I sit down to write, I haven't got a million notifications going off my phone and my laptop and stuff, because I was trying to think about the difference between, and it's quite a subtle one, between a distraction and an interruption. Mm-hmm. Okay? So to use a different example, because I work from home, so you know it's difficult for people to empathize with my situation. But imagine in your situation, Di, there are things in your classroom which are distractions, and there's things which are interruptions. So if someone comes, you know, knocking on your classroom door or bursting into your classroom, that's an interruption, but you probably want that because it's going to be important. No one's going to interrupt you like that unless mm-hmm. it's important. So in my life, that's my wife phoning me, that's someone coming knocking on my office door, etc. That's fine. But I feel like distractions are things which are self-imposed. Like you've created the situation in which you're being distracted. So these, for me, are things like Slack notifications, Telegram notifications, RSS things popping up, whatever it is. For you, I guess it might be what? Like having stuff in your classroom which takes your attention away from teaching and learning. Yeah. So I thought, well, I need some kind of device where I can do this. And I looked at buying all different kinds of things and whatever. And then I realized I should just make use of what I've got. So I've got this spare monitor because I upgraded to that 4K one. And it rotates and it is height adjustable. And I've got a Raspberry Pi. And I thought, well, surely that's all I need. So I hooked it up, and there's a picture of it there in the blog post. And it kind of worked. It was really slow, etc. And then I realized that actually I could just use whatever I've got. And the reason for that is because almost every smartphone and laptop operating system includes a guest mode or like multiple users. I don't know if... Does iOS do that?
I don't believe it does. Apple stuff, I don't know. iOS is changing, but it's a single user thing.
Hmm. Well, if you use, you know, but even like macOS, that allows you to sign in with multiple users. So if you do a guest account or whatever, then you can just easily switch between these on Android or I'm using Ubuntu, and I kind of go through this in the post. And on Android, all you need to do is to select that on guest mode, you can make and receive phone calls. And then because you're not then signed into all of your apps, literally all that can happen is someone can phone you, which is great. That's what I want. Like, I don't want anyone else to be messaging me. I don't want to pay any attention to that. And then on Ubuntu, we just make another account, which you can call whatever you want, guest or writing or whatever. Give it a standard rather than administrator permissions. And then it literally just gives you the default version of your browser and everything like that. Then you can get away typing. So that's what I did today. I was writing the Moodle Net paper, and I had my phone in guest mode, and I had my operating system in this guest login, and then I didn't have any distractions. It was
good. No, that does make absolute sense. So I did think this when you were setting up your, I saw somewhere that you were setting up your Raspberry Pi, and I just thought, surely there's a means of just getting your computer to be able to do that for you. Thing. And I think there will be.
Yep.
Well, I mean, it's pretty standard now. So you can switch on Windows now. I use Windows and work, and Windows 10 has a very easy switch user thing where you could have that set up really easily to stop it blipping at you and telling you things have arrived, this, that, and the other. Although Windows is full of far too many notifications for my comfort, just about your system and this, that, and the other. But. Cool. Very good.
Yes. There's a few things about coding in here. The links we've got left for those listening. One is about a half-educated tech elite. That's all about the people who are making our world, who have invented these companies, tend to have a background not in the humanities, but pretty much only in like maths uh-huh. and computer science, which they're saying in this article that they're half educated. There's a nice thing about not just teaching kids to code, but getting them to question people like Facebook and Google. There's an article on our interview with Mitch Resnick, who is the Lego professor of play at MIT Media Lab. about future of coding in schools, and then the one which I'd love to talk about, which is the new Facebook app for children. What do you reckon?
I just think we should do them in the order there. Should we do that? There's no problem with that.
Okay.
So half-educated tech lead delivered us into chaos, says John Norton in The Guardian. So what's he really trying to say? He's trying to say that all these people in these big tech companies that are dictating how life, or determining rather than dictating how life is actually happening for a lot of people, really, that their education is limited and therefore it's going in a certain direction because of that.
Well, the subtitle is, if our super smart tech leaders knew a bit more about history or philosophy, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in now. So I've seen some other stuff this week, which was talking about the decisions that were made in the early days of like doing network protocols like TCP/IP, and how it was okay for them to just work because no one was really expecting, you know, the internet to be such a huge thing. Like, you know, even people who were thinking it was going to be awesome didn't realize that we're going to be spending so much of our lives on it. And so made decisions for things just to work rather than spending more time on security and performance and that kind of thing. And I feel that's the same thing for Facebook, etc. So Facebook, you know, started as a thing for a particular group of people in Harvard and then has grown to be all over the world. But there's still structural decisions which were made initially which affect the way it is now. And also, because things have grown so quickly, and because the people in charge haven't got any kind of background in the more like the softer sciences and like the human side of you know, learning about the world, John Norton saying that they're essentially half educated because of that.
I think that, yeah, I think that's an absolute right thing. And if you look at the idea, so where this doesn't seem harmful is if you take Twitter as an example. So you set up Twitter, you get some traction, you get lots of users, people are using it. And the joy of Twitter in its early days was that it was exactly what you made it to be. So the people that you followed became the information you got in your timeline. It happened chronologically. You could go back through it if you'd not been on for a while and check what people had, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It was just a real clean delivery of things that people were sharing. But then when you start building in the different algorithms and the advertising and such like, it distorts all of that. And it's those decisions there that are the ones that are, I think, half educated is kind of the wrong phrase for this. But they're going to happen with bias, aren't they? The people making those decisions are going to be biased towards particular things. And then you obviously get into shareholder world once the companies float and where they're just pushing for more and more users. So therefore, they're trying to do you get into the attention capture economy, and which is what we're really facing now, rather than products just delivering what they say on the tin kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. And I think one of the problems is not really understanding, this sounds ridiculous, but what it means to be human. Right, because if you've only got your own life and those of your peer group to go off, who are very much like you, it's a bit like, I don't know if you've read anything about Mark Zuckerberg's tour of America, which he's doing, you know, in preparation for this presidential bid. But from what I've read, he's been very surprised by the fact that, oh, look, poor people come together through churches and different groups to provide solidarity with one another. Like, he is literally not aware of what an unprivileged upbringing is like. And in the MoodleNet paper, I've been talking about identity, and I'll not rehearse everything that's in there because, you know, people can go away and read that for themselves. But it did make me look back at a guy called Chris Poole, who is Moot, the founder of 4chan. And in 2011, he did this talk at the Web 2.0 summit and was talking about identity. And he said, complexity in identity is what defines our humanity. And it's just an 8.5 minute long talk, but it's so powerful in terms of like our identity being prismatic and not being like a mirror. We don't have one identity like when you look in the mirror. It's prismatic, like the facets of a diamond. And the closest one to that is, I guess, Twitter, because you can have multiple accounts, but it's still not allowing you to be different people, different type of person in different spaces, in the sense that, you know, Di, you're different, I'm guessing, with your brothers than with your parents, than with like a partner, or with your with your colleagues, etc. We play a different role in different relationships, but that's not very well represented in our interactions online. Sometimes we expect it to be the same person in every situation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's absolutely right, and you need to be able to be complex. And I don't think you have a lot of choice of whether, you know, if you try to be the same person in all of those spots, you're still not, because it's the way that people, like my parents, perceive me as a certain thing. And they're always shocked by my behavior, which I never really understand. by the things I do and say, they don't understand. It doesn't compute to them. And because they want me to be a certain thing, and they perceive me, I can be that thing in their minds very easily. But the reality of my life is I might not be that thing, you know, and it might be something different. And then the obvious complexity of being human is that you're different things in different places, as you're saying. And it's like, because you can't be all things in all places, can you? We are
all things to all men, all of the women and the children, sang Roots Maneuver. So I think they're definitely onto something there. And I think that, you know, at the same time as we're pushing everyone to do coding, etc., I think, well, I would say this, because the reason I love this article is because John Norton talks about history and philosophy, which are, you know, my two main subjects. So, like, obviously, I think that's a great idea. But at the same time, you know, we should be teaching kids as much history and philosophy as coding. So,
well, I mean, quite interestingly, so the conversations that I have with my current upper sixth class orient around ethics and philosophy, I guess, really, of how technology is emerging and how it's controlling people and how it's, you know, we talk a lot about that. And they're fascinated by that, in that they're, not all of them, but a couple of them are really fascinated by the idea of how, despite being scientists and mathematicians, without exception, no other qualification going on, that they're interested in what's going on for the people because of all of these things. What's going on, you know, driverless cars, what's going on with this, what's going on with that. And they're identifying at their young age the inconsistencies of how people treat technology issues, sort of thing, which is fascinating. And it's interesting here is a paragraph towards the end of this article by John Norton, all of which brings to mind C.P. Snow's famous Two Cultures lecture, which is linked to in the article, should you be interested, delivered in Cambridge in 1959, in which he lamented the fact that the intellectual life of the whole of Western society was scarred by the gap between the opposing cultures of science and engineering on one hand and the humanities on the other, with the latter, that's the humanities, holding the upper hand among contemporary ruling elites. Snow thought that this perverse dominance would deprive Britain of the intellectual capacity to thrive in the post-war world, and he clearly longed to reverse it.
Right.
That's quite it. So they're talking about humanities being dominant at this point, 40, 50, 60 years ago.
Well, I feel like the web is so important for the life that we live. And, you know, people say, oh, well, what do you mean by the web? Like, doesn't everyone use apps now? But really, you know, even now, if you get an app, a lot of them are progressive web apps or hybrid apps or whatever. Like, they all rely on the web to some extent. And one of my former colleagues in Mozilla, Christian Heilman, who now works at Microsoft, for of all organizations, he talks about net neutrality, and is the particular post, which I've just put in the show notes, is entitled "The Web We May Have Lost." And in this, he talks about the things we take for granted now, and how it's almost like in the past, because there's net neutrality ruling, which has happened since we last spoke, which means that, for those who haven't been keeping track, it means that internet service providers can treat different packets of data differently depending on where they've come from. So, for example, Netflix could pay the ISP more to make sure that their packets of data were on the fast lane, whereas, you know, me sending a file to you, Di, because I'm not paying the ISP, would be in the slow lane, etc. Like, it's at least a two-tier internet in terms of those who can pay and who can't. and it's a fundamental change to what's going on. And he talks about, he likens it to water. He says, that Christian Hellman says, I understand that for people who grew up always online, the web is nothing special. It's just there, like running water when you open a tap. You only care about the water when it doesn't come. And he just goes through about all this kind of stuff about how the web, he's basically built his career on the open web and how that's under threat. So I thought that was an interesting one to throw in there.
I think that's absolutely right, isn't it? It's a nice analogy. I saw another analogy, which we're probably going to talk about, I think, one of the other articles about coding, learning to code, being aligned to learning to write. And it's not that everyone needs to be a writer, it's that everyone needs to know how to write. And this is similar. Water is the same thing. So if water was to start being polluted and we couldn't drink it, people would be up in arms and getting that fixed kind of thing. It would be a massive national crisis. And the internet has become the same. It's that people just expect access to the internet, and they expect that access to be fair and good. And that's the net.
But I think people don't get the issues. I mean, if you look at the first comment on this post by Christian Hellman, for example, okay, this person looks a bit alt-right, etc. But he says, quote, "You people crack me up. Oh, the apocalypse. It's Monday. Did anyone lose their internet speed yet? Just like before Obama's deplorable net neutrality bill, the internet was free and growing. So it will continue to grow and prosper post-net neutrality apocalypse," end of quote. And so this is someone who doesn't understand that it's not about internet speed. It's a, like more generally, like, oh, you're not cutting the internet speed to your house. It's more insidious than that. Like, you won't notice the difference of what's going on until it's too late. And it doesn't create an even playing field. It stacks the deck in favor of venture capitalist-backed organizations that can pay to play. And so I really like the next article.
Hang on, I agree with you. And the point that, so the way that this will work is that you'll simply just not receive the thing, or when was the last time that you turned a web page off because it wasn't loading and it didn't load quick enough, and then you just didn't actually ever go back and look at that web page again. And that's the sort of thing that will start to happen and creep in. And whereas the thing that gets delivered quickly will be the thing that you go and read. And again, we go back to this sort of, it's just reinforcing the recommendation engines, really, where you're homogenizing people's behavior.
Yeah, exactly. And so what will happen, I guess, is that just as I've seen stuff about how really Amazon is so dominant when it comes to online retail, you know, in terms of how, I don't know how many out of 10 transactions are bought through Amazon, but it's a lot, certainly more than five, something like six or seven. It means that shops effectively use Amazon as their selling platform and just accept the fact that Amazon take a cut. So all of a sudden, these large internet behemoths become the ones who can pay to play, and therefore you have to use their platform, otherwise you're in the hinterlands of not being able to get people to your site fast enough.
Completely. So that's a bit like Spotify, you would say, for music at the moment, and Apple Music and Google Music. You know, that's what they have. Yeah. You have these very few silos which you have to get your music into to be successful within that industry. I noticed today that Toys R Us, which is a huge toy shop chain in the UK, I don't know if it's big outside of the UK, but they are closing 26 shops. They're closing in the UK, losing over 3,000 jobs or something like that. You know, they're unable to sustain their business model. We keep forgetting that we can't, you know, you sort of think that, oh, well, hasn't all that change happened? Well, no, it hasn't. And the impact of the increasing use of technology is going to continue to be seen, sort of thing. It is.
Yeah, and just to link that to the next article, which is, again, in The Guardian and entitled, "Don't Just Teach Kids to Code, Teach Them to Question Facebook and Google." I feel like this is an important part of our democracy. Like, we need to, like, one of the elements of my digital literacies is that kind of civic element, and also the, you know, the critical element, being able to critique the current situation. You need to know enough to be able to critique things. And so in this article, John Harris, who writes just as well as John Norton about this kind of stuff, he says, "The importance of computing education also cuts straight to what is arguably the biggest cultural issue of our time. our increasingly lamentable collective relationship with the internet and what that means for our lives. The idea that Facebook and Google are coming close to killing the internet's last residue of anarchic democracy by colonizing the online world is a cliche, but only because it's true. Their dominance depends on the way that most people now blindly obey their diktats in the same way that my generation gawped at the TV, not least the young people who are immersed in the social media world and often find themselves vulnerable to its worst excesses. The only way you can even start to reverse all that is by prising off the digital facade and encouraging people to remake the online world as they want. End of quote.
Well, I think that's right, isn't it? But I think it's going to be harder and harder. So I think there's different things going on. Like GAFA, which is Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon, are taking over the world. They're just, you know what I mean? That's really is what's going on. You know, Google and Apple are the biggest companies in the world now. And they weren't. They are now. And there is no, we've talked a lot before about how if the USA and the EU are unable to take on these massive companies, which they aren't, they want them. They want their business. They want to court them. They don't want to annoy them. And all of that.
Well, I don't know. I think GDPR is pissing them off quite a lot.
GDPR is quite a good way of doing that. But from my point of view, Google and Microsoft passed GDPR very, very quickly. They're the first because they're such big organizations to just get the lawyers onto it and make sure that they've documentation in place to sort of deal with that. In fact, GDPR actually made that much clearer from Google because Google had to come out and declare that they were GDPR safe pretty early doors. So, and that doesn't kick in until May, I think, next year. But nonetheless, I think it's a really, really important thing, and something you'll always get in my classroom is exactly this: is that I will be teaching the children to question what it is that they find on the internet, to how they access it, to make sure that they're not being filtered, but they're setting up their own filters, their own feeds. They're curating the net, they're sourcing their information, and it comes back to the very basic principles of healthy consumption of information. And so I think John Harris, who wrote this article, is right to compare it to television. Certainly, I know there's a lot of pressure on me to provide excellent internet to our borders, for example, because that's how they consume their entertainment. And a lot of that is watching YouTube as television, as people would have watched television in the past, even though they have a lot more choice about what they want.
Well, it goes back to, you know, people talk about natural markets and da-da-da, but really, you know, capitalism works because we make it work. Actually, you know, there is no market in internet service, you know, in terms of net neutrality and stuff. We're creating a market there when we get rid of net neutrality. Like, that's the deal. So making and sustaining markets is what the state does. And so we don't have to do things that way, which I know it sounds anarchist and crazy, but yeah, it's true. And the older I get, the more I realize that the world doesn't have to be the way that it has been. We can do things differently.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thing, you know. And it's sad that you feel, and this is a problem, I think. Who is it earlier that you cited somebody on, and I went and looked at their Twitter profile, and they had something about fighting fascism in their banner picture at the top of Twitter, you think it's anarchic and things like that, but if you actually look at Adam Smith, you know, who is not a left wing, he's an economist of the right wing kind of thing. And he would just say the market is a good slave, but a bad master. Right. And the problem is that the market has become master. And that's what we see in a lot of the things that we talk about, really. And that's what Adam Curtis talks about in Hypernormalization and Bitter Lake, his two documentaries, which are not party political, but they do talk about politics and political trends and things like that. Events and it is that thing. It's quite simply that greed, getting more for the individual, is not a good thing to, a good condition to set your country in, or indeed the economies in, and that you need to control the markets, just as you said there. You need the government's job is to control the markets and to set out the stores so that people can go and serve their own interests within society. But if you don't control those markets, if that control is not happening, then what you end up with is Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon, sadly.
Yeah. And I think that people, you know, when you think of sci-fi and that kind of thing, like, we're expecting megacorps to look like they do in Judge Dredd, like to look evil, yeah? Rather than, like, it's in the best interests of large digital organizations not to look evil. It's in their best interest to look fluffy and friendly and, you know, to be on the user's side, etc., whilst raking in all of your data and money.
Absolutely. I mean, the greatest TV program franchise never written is What the Hell is Going On in the Rest of the Earth for Star Trek. I think if you take Star Trek and you get this lovely facade of whatever it is, I'm not a particular Star Trek fan, but I've watched a lot of it in my time. If you think about what are they called? What's it called? The USS Enterprise? What are they part of? Some kind of federation or whatever. But if you look at the underneath of that and what's going on for all the people who aren't the brightest in their class and half Vulcan and whatever, and what's going on Earth and that, and how that happens to create this. You know, I watched a little bit of the new Star Trek that came out recently with a female lead, and it was interesting that. I was kind of on the side of the Klingons in a way. It's like I've just found myself with very split loyalties against this very squeaky clean sort of tech savvy set of people working for whomever it is, the goodies, you know? And I think that's right, is that the corporations, of course they all seem good, of course it all seems natural, and they will always find good motivations with which to distract you from their wider goal of becoming financially dominant within the world and and invincible. I think that is the ultimate goal of these companies, is to become invincible, is that Google cannot be killed, cannot be usurped, yeah. No one can come
too big to fail.
Exactly, yeah. And that's that. And they're so big that they can make such enormous product U-turns or whatever they might need to do that they and they will survive. Boom.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. Boom. Mic drop. Absolutely. Yeah.
So let's look at the Mick Resnick thing here. Mitch Resnick, sorry, is the looking at the future of coding in schools.
Yeah. So this one where is it? So this one in particular, the future of coding in schools. I can't decide whether the image which accompanies this article is endearing or really creepy.
Mitch staring down at a little
bat. Like the intensity of Mitch Resnick's stare at this young boy. Yeah. I'm not insinuating anything other than a deep pedagogic interest, but yeah, Mitch Resnick seems fascinated by what the guy's saying, which is awesome. So Mitch Resnick, who I've only ever met in person twice, and one of the times we had a debate about the value of badges, a good-natured debate, but you know, a debate nonetheless. He, you know, he's in a different stratosphere to me and my work, but I really like some of the stuff he says. He's not like beating the drum and saying, oh, everyone must code, all this kind of stuff. And he talks about passion, he talks about integration, he talks about democracy, breaking down barriers, and, you know, not assessing coding and stuff by doing exams, but by taking, he says, I would take a portfolio-like approach to assessment, looking at what kids create. And he references the Scratch community, and he says there's difficult to arrive at quantitative measures, but I also think we don't actually necessarily need to. And yeah, I just think it's a really nice interview, especially if you're having to convince people of the value of coding, especially in schools.
Yeah, so this is where the writing line I referred to earlier came from. So I quote Resnick in saying, "Very few people grow up to be professional writers, but we teach everyone to write because it's a way of communicating with others, of organizing your thoughts and expressing your ideas. I think the reasons for learning to code are the same as the reasons for learning to write. When we learn to write, we are learning how to organize, express, and share ideas. And when we learn to code, we are learning how to organize, express, and share ideas in new ways in a new medium." Which is a ton of time of learning to write, so is writing. So, and I think that's absolutely right. I think everybody needs to be aware of code, and everyone needs to be aware of how a computer works, of how it delivers information, that an app is the internet and an internet is an app. It's all the same nonsense. And they need to know about recommendation engines. They need to know about homogenization, because you're dealing with millions and millions and millions and millions of users, not just people like you in your country anymore. And I think all these things are really, really important. And that's why I think it's right. Where should it be? So it's compulsory at the moment in the state sector, from key stage 1 to key stage 3, or maybe even key stage 4, I think, which is from the age of 5 to 17, 16, potentially. That's a lot of it. And I don't think there's a need for that to happen in the same way, really. But I certainly, I like the fact that Mitch has taken the emphasis away from the idea that people are learning to be computer programmers. That's not what's happening. They're learning how to communicate and how to talk and the internet.
No, exactly. And I think it's so difficult these days, because people can point to the same stuff and come to vastly different conclusions, like the, you know, the banning mobiles in the classroom thing and the laptops are great kind of stuff we were talking about. And it depends at the end of the day on what your vision of the world is and your vision of a good society. And I think that if you disagree fundamentally on what constitutes a good society, you're going to differ on the means of getting there. And so that will include technological decisions, etc.
Yes, absolutely. And it is going to be, it's important. So if we look back to those things about the science and engineers versus the humanities people, educated people, being in tech companies, making the decisions, this is the important part. The important point is that people who are educated in those other things just say, "Oh, you've lost me now. I don't even know how to work my iPad," or that kind of thing. And that's not okay. You know, and that is going to go away naturally by itself. You're going to get less and less people saying that sort of thing. But also, it's not okay that people aren't educated in technology. Everyone needs to be educated in technology, whether they like it or not, because it has such an influence on everybody's life.
I've had a conversation this week with somebody who has said that their organization's focus for 2018 is digital. And I'm like,
yep, screwed.
Right, which part?
Yeah, no, they need to. Well, I don't know. That it's an interesting thing is if they, I mean, I don't want to ask about the individual in case they're listening, but it is, but that's just rubbish, isn't it? That's like saying we're going to focus on, what does that mean? Digital is everything. Everything is digital. It's just silly.
Well, exactly. I wanted to talk about the Facebook app, which came out at the start of December. Facebook's been doing lots of different things, including, I think they've called it Facebook Workplace. They've basically got a workplace chat app, which they're not making a big song and dance about, but which is being used by a lot of organizations worldwide now, and a bit like Slack, etc. And this is literally a ploy for world domination by Facebook. And they said that there's the reason for rolling out Messenger Kids, which can be used by children under the age of 13, is that they were concerned that the age limit of 13 meant that kids were using it, having their own Facebook account, kind of, not illegally, but like without permission. And so the way that you get the Messenger Kids app is that your parent signs you up for it, basically, and they can, and the parents get to approve or reject friend requests, etc. And so for me, I can understand as a parent, I can understand why Facebook have done this. It totally makes sense for them. But it just seems, I know the kids are under 13, but it just seems extremely paternalistic. And
it seems paternalistic.
Yeah.
Did you say?
Yeah. And which is bizarre, isn't it? Because you think, well, okay, kids are under 13. So like, surely there should be paternalism there. Surely there should be a strong sense of your parents being involved in your social network. But like, it doesn't, like, I don't know. Maybe I'm just.
Well, I think. I mean, I think. No, I think this is a good thing. I mean, one of the things that is dull is like when people won't tell the truth about something, and people have been telling this truth for many years, particularly in schools, is that children have been using Facebook at the inappropriate age for a long, long time. And as an adult, because the turn on age is 13, then you just say, well, you can have Facebook when you're 13. So the child just goes and makes it and makes out that they're 18 or whatever to get on Facebook. And then when you tell them there's under 18 accounts, so you must tell your real age in Facebook. And they said, oh, well, I was 18 5 years ago and they're only 12 as it is. And they're doing that on purpose because they want to participate in the real thing. So one of the things that I would say that a parent would want to do is if social media is not going to be a question, they want to be able to to introduce their children to Facebook and allow them to participate, especially since a lot of parents will be talking to their friends. If their Facebook account is something that their children can see, they might, you know, they'll be sharing videos that they get on Facebook and this, that, and the other. And in a lot of families, people deal with Facebook in different ways. So some people will be using it, like the couple of the family, the adults, won't be friends on Facebook because they'll use it as a part of just fueling their social lives. A kind of thing, their personal separate social lives, not their lives together, which they live together. And people use these things.
I suppose so. But I mean, my son and my niece, so my son is 11 next month, and my niece was 12 at the weekend. Like, they're both on PATH, the social network which we use as a family. And I guess, I suppose I don't like this because it's Facebook and I feel like they're data mining and they're doing it so that they've got another way to monetize a new audience, which is children, so they can continue growing.
You don't feel like that. You know that. That's true.
Right, so it's because it's Facebook. But then my niece and my son are both on PATH, which is a social network I just use in my family. And I'm not in control of who they friend on there, but they know that that's a family space and we're modeling kind of behaviors and how to interact with each other and stuff on there. And I just feel like, I suppose they are under 30 and stuff. I suppose my instant reaction to anything Facebook does is suspicion.
Yeah.
And I suppose this is the obvious way that social networkers would go. Yeah.
Yeah, they are not. The issue is with this company and with all these big companies, I think, is that they provide these services for free. And why do they do that? They do that so they can secure a greater percentage of the market share, which will satisfy their shareholders, the attention economy, and all of these things. And they do have bad motives or disingenuous motives, if you like. But then, like, providing a service like this, the question is how have they arrived at that? And why is it the case? So have they arrived at that because they understand that it's going to align with those interests that we just specified, those ones that you and I would consider bad things? Or have they realized that they need to actually create a better service that allows parents to be connected to their children, to introduce their children into this social media platform and in a better, in a kind of managed way? And do it in graduation, you know, and sort of approve different friends and make sure that they've got their control over it. And then also monitor their behavior and see what they're doing. I imagine this includes your ability to look at your child's messages and see what they're saying to each other, which is a crazy invasion of privacy. And if I was a child, I'd be thinking, no way am I doing that. I don't know what kind of conversations you had growing up, but the ones I had are not the ones that I would have in front of my parents with my friends kind of thing. So in the main, and so... I think it is Facebook trying, you know, not doing something good as such, but I do think that if you were going to accept that Facebook are here to stay, and that they are going to be a significant communications platform, which you are using and you use it yourself, then and that your children are going to go onto it, then the sooner you could get them onto it, the better. All that's going to happen, though, is as you normalize this behavior and children want to go and get things wrong and try out different online profiles, as it were, like we discussed earlier, different parts of themselves, express themselves in different ways to different people, they're going to go and find other places where parents can't be, I would say.
Exactly. And, you know, we all have the fear around, you know, our children connecting with the wrong people and, you know, paedophiles and, you know, like bullying and all that kind of stuff. But I feel like you do that by supporting your child's independence and giving them good decision-making tools rather than just always giving them a sandpit that you're patrolling.
I mean, people aren't worried about a stranger danger as much as they're worried about their kid's life going significantly wrong in some way. And if that happens, then it's going to be hopefully in a place where the child can get it fixed pretty quickly and get help and all of that kind of thing. And that's really what you want to do. So when your child starts drinking, for example, that's what you want. You want your child not to never drink. You want them to take a drink in an environment where there's going to be somebody brave and bold and sensible enough to blow the whistle should it be going wrong, and that kind of thing. And I don't know many people that have been completely upfront with their parent. When I was growing up, certainly, where they were upfront with their parents about what they were doing, in a kind of drink way, drugs way, the way they spoke, sex. All these different types of things that people might have, that people would explore and try in different ways. And they weren't really upfront with their parents about it because their parents had such a different set of opinions about these things. But I think that's changing.
Right. So as more and more of our conversations with people happen, like we don't need to be in the same space as people all the time. So because we don't have to be in the same space to have conversations with them, then we aren't. And that's a legitimate and useful thing to do. But it does mean that our interactions with people at a distance are using services which then, unless we configure them otherwise, are then recorded for all of posterity, it would seem. And that isn't the same as normal ephemeral conversation. Like, you know, and things can be interpreted in different ways, yeah? So if we were having this conversation and it wasn't recorded, it would be lost to the wind and time. But the fact that we're recording it means that years hence, you know, the fact that I've mentioned my anti-capitalist stance or increasing anti-capitalist stance could be used against me. Yeah.
Good, depending on what you want to do. And if you wanted to run for public office, for example, which you might still do in your life or something like that, and these things, it could go significantly against you. Interestingly, what you just said there about that indelibility, I mean, that's where Snapchat have captured the market of the disappearing message. Right. And I noticed that Signal have also done that. So Signal, you can now turn on a feature where the messages will disappear.
Yeah, in Telegram you can do that. And I started doing that with my wife and she was like, why have you done that? Because that means that I can't then search back through history to say what you said about this thing or that link that you sent me or whatever. So it becomes like annoying to the people in the conversation if you do that. It becomes like, because you can do something, you should do that.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. So I played about that with that in Signal in a group chat. So I set it down to quite short on the idea that if you're in the group chat and you're not there at the moment of the chat when people are talking, then the message doesn't happen. And you don't get to see it, you don't get to read it, which I think is quite fascinating. But then the other thing is that people contribute towards these things. They want people to be able to see what they wrote because they think they're funny or they shared a picture or something like that, and people aren't always there in the moment to get it. So someone expanded it to an hour. Until the messages disappeared, which you can control the time. And I thought that was interesting. But ultimately, the conversation in the group died because there wasn't that sort of history in it.
You couldn't go back to stuff, yeah, if there was a lull. Like everything had to be the start of a new conversation rather than picking up on something before.
Yeah, and then and it's like, who does that? And the serendipity of, like, you know, there being several people around at the same time and having a sort of big group chat whilst you're in there, you know, whatever. Things like that. And so I think these things are complicated and you'll get different tools for different jobs, sort of thing. But children love, young people love Snapchat.
Right.
End of.
Yeah. And part of that is the gamified features and all that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, the streaks and all of that kind of. To the extent that a child, this is quite funny. So if a child goes, we get this quite often with our parents. If pupils go on school trips, they're not allowed to take their phones. They give their parents their phone. So if they're going camping or something, or they're going somewhere that's got no signal, so they give their parents their phone with the passlock to their phone so that their parents can continue their streaks that they've got on Snapchat.
Really?
So you think that's where You know, so they clean their phone out to make sure their parents can see it, but they still got all their stuff logged in, but they must, yeah, exactly. They have to do, that's bonkers, isn't it? You think about it. It's that's how important those sorts of things can be.
That's like, can you, you know, play with my Tamagotchi kind of thing?
It's exactly like that.
Yeah.
No, wasn't there an interesting thing about something to do with Tamagotchis recently?
I think they're bringing them back as an app, yeah.
Is it a new, it's an app, yes, absolutely. So there's something going on.
I was just going to say that just now I found that, you know, the people who do the Horizon reports every year?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
They're called the New Media Consortium.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, I've just seen that on EdSearch, it says New Media Consortium unexpectedly shuts down, citing errors and omissions by CFO, Chief Financial Officer. So basically they've gone bust and they might have to sell some of their assets
through administration. Yeah,
they might have to sell some of their assets to pay for their bankruptcy or whatever, which is amazing.
Wow, that is huge.
Yeah, which is amazing. So basically there's going to be no more Horizon reports. And although it did start feeling a bit like Groundhog Day with those Horizon reports, and although Audrey Waters did kind of critique them rather heavily for their predictions not actually going anywhere, it is a shame because they did some interesting work around digital literacies and
okay. Very, very rare for a non-profit organization to cease operations so suddenly. It's catastrophic, said Johnson, who is now CEO of Ed Futures, another non-profit supporting education. It speaks to how could that happen? Who's minding the store? Don't know. Well, that is a big blow. I mean, we can't take these, you know, I remember, I mean, we've said not very nice things necessarily about Horizon reports and such like. But if you don't have anyone doing this research and putting this out, like, you know, this is like a census of the web kind of thing and how things are being used within schools. And obviously it has its inaccuracies, but if you don't have anyone doing this, that without that information, the people who are going to start making that information happen are going to be tech sponsored, big tech corp sponsored, and blah 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 blah.
Well, I mean, they did get criticised for doing a digital literacy report with Adobe, I was actually asked to be involved in a follow up to that, which obviously isn't going to happen, and I refused because I didn't want to do research where the outcome was almost preordained, although that might be unfair to the people who are doing it. But yeah, certainly it looks like they were trying to do things differently before this announcement. So yeah, it is a shame. And I know that people like Alan Levine, Cogdog, he was doing stuff back in the day with NMC, and I like the way that they went about doing the Horizon report, even if the report itself was, you know, much of a not muchness. They did it in a kind of a wiki-based way, and people could weigh in, and it was a nice way of doing it. So yeah, that is a bit of a shock and a bit of a shame. And, you know, off the back of the Mozilla announcement that, you know, they're no longer having a learning team, it's a bit of a, yeah, I guess this is what you expect when Trump becomes president.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, it's Christmas time, so we shouldn't end on a low note, we should end on a high note. You're already on holiday.
I am.
It's my birthday on Friday.
Happy birthday, Doug.
It's Christmas on Monday.
Happy Christmas, Doug.
Thank you. Happy Christmas to you, Di. And happy Christmas to everybody who listens to the end of our podcast every time. And sometimes respond to some of the things that Di and I say at the end. So thank you for bearing with us through these long podcasts all year. We're going to be back in 2018. Depending on our schedules, they might be weekly, bi-weekly, monthly, but we'll get them out, and you can listen to our dulcet tones throughout 2018.
Lucky you, hey?
Where are you going to be for Christmas, Di? Are you going to be at home? Are you going to be away?
I am. I'm in Andor for a little while, and then I'm going up to see my parents in Hull. I've been down to London to do that part of things, and then I fly to India on Boxing Day. So that's going to be an awesome trip of all sorts of different kinds of things with 20 children. So it should be good. What about you? What are you doing?
Well, I have dropped heavy hints to my wife about getting Battlefront 2. And because my birthday is so close to Christmas, the theory from when I was younger, my parents always say I used to get the same amount of presents. Sometimes they were combined, but the same kind of value. And so I've carried that through into adulthood. And so I've dropped strong hints that the Battlefront 2 game I should get for my birthday rather than Christmas, because my wife's teaching on Friday, my kids will be at school, and I would like to spend a lot of the day playing Battlefront 2, which would be awesome, because I might actually be able to beat my son, who is increasingly good at computer games. So is that. Christmas will be at home, and then we're going down to Devon for New Year to be with the in-laws, and then I start my 4 days a week with Moodle on the 2nd of January, so only really just over a week off.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm back in town on, I think I land on the 9th or the 8th or the 9th of January, and then I'm working straight away. So I don't know if I'll be ready for Tide that week. I'll have to check the dates exactly. But I could possibly do a quick Happy New Year on Tide.
So maybe another week off, another month off. But that's just the way things go. It's no regular podcast these days, but hopefully it's quality rather than quantity.
hopefully.
Anyway, have a wonderful Christmas New Year, Di, and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all our listeners.
Ditto. Happy Christmas, everyone. Watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.